ज्ञानं जनशलाकय चाक्षुरुन्मीलितं येन तस्मै श्रीगुरवे नमः नाम श्रेष्ठं मनुमापि सच्चिपुत्रम् अत्र स्वरूपं रूपं तस्याग्रजमरूपरिं माथुरीं गोष्ठावतीं राधाकुन्दं गिरिवरं महो राधिकमधावशं प्राप्तो यस्य प्रतीत्यकृपाया श्रीगुरुं तं नतोऽस्मि वञ्चकल्पतरुभ्यश्च कृपा सिन्धुभ्यैव च पतितानं पवानेभ्यो वैष्णवेभ्यो नमो नमः निखिलाश्रुतिमौलिरत्नमालयते निराजितपदपङ्कजन्त आजि मुक्तकुलैरुपश्यामनं परितष्टं हरिणं संश्रयामि अनारपितचरिं चिरात् करुणयावतीर्णाकलः समार्पयितुमुन्नतोज्ज्वलरासं स्वभक्तिश्रियं हरिपुरतसुन्दरादीतिकदम्बसन्दीपितः सदा हृदये कन्दरे स्फुरतो वासुचिनन्दनः अजानुलम्बिता भुजो कनकावदतो सङ्कीर्तनैकपितरो कमलायतक्ष विश्वम्बरो द्विजाबरो जुगधर्मपाल वन्दे जगत्प्रियकरो करुणावतारो लादिनीशक्तिस्वरूपाय गौरङ्गसुहृदाय च भक्तशक्तिप्रदनाय गदाधर नमस्तुते हे कृष्ण करुणा सिंधु दीनाबंधो जगतपते गोपेशा गोपिका कांत राधा कांत नमस्तुते राधे वृंदवनादिशे करुणामृत वाहिने कृपया निज पादब्जा दशन्मयं प्रदीयतम् भक्त्या विहीनाय अपराध लक्षाय क्षिप्ताश्चाकमादितरंगमाध्ये कृपामयि त्वं शरणं प्रपानं वृन्देन्मस्ते चरणारविन्दम् श्री सचिनंदन गौर हरि की जय श्री हरि नाम प्रभु की जय श्री श्री गौर नित्यानंद की जय श्री श्री गौर गदाधर जी की जय श्री श्री राधा गोविंद की जय गौर भक्त वृंद की जय गौर प्रेमानंद हरि हरि बोल सो प्रणाम टू ऑल ऑफ यू वेलकम एंड थैंक यू सो मच Kumal Kumari and Rupa Vilas Prabhu and for name for the invitation today, and it's my good fortune. As Kumal Kumari was mentioning, she feels really grateful and really blessed to be here now, in the here and now with all of you today. That's reciprocal. I was just thinking, I'm waiting for her to finish and I will copy paste her words and say the same from my own heart. It's my real fortune to be here with you, and hopefully these are not just words, no? Because it's so easy to fall into words. We have so many words, so dangerous. So it's so important to make a committed use of each of our words, knowing that every word will call for a walking of the talk. Even when we say, I feel so blessed to be with all of you, that has a price to say that. No, it's so nice to be here with all of you. It has a price to say that. No, a beautiful price that hopefully we are willing to pay. So by saying this, I'm publicly committing myself to pay the price for saying the words, I'm very happy to be here with all of you. Whatever the reaction of those words is, I'm willing to embrace that beautiful reaction. And hopefully all of us as well, because that's the idea of getting together and that's the idea of Sadhu Sangha, that both of us feel this is a blessed moment and both of us are willing to honor the blessing of the moment by honoring the fruit that comes from that blessing of that particular moment, and so on and so forth. So that said, today's the first lecture somehow of my 2024 tour, in at least the first English lecture, since I gave a few talks in Colombia now, but in Spanish as well as in Argentina before that. So we'll start today with a very interesting topic. Actually, during this visit to Alachua, most of my topics will revolve around Mahaprabhu, since we are kind of warming up for Gaur Purnim. So many of the devotees who invited me in a loving way gave me no option but to talk about Mahaprabhu. Right, Pranada and Archan Siddhi? Okay, yeah, thank you. So very lovingly, they canceled my free will and they just invited me without a second option, if you want to call that an invitation, to talk about Mahaprabhu, which of course is not any tapasya, it's my greatest pleasure. But also we'll be talking about a few other topics, apparently unrelated, but never totally unrelated, since ultimately reality is non-dual and everything, Advaita Gyan Tattva, as the Bhagavatam say, reality is non-dual consciousness. So ultimately everything is interconnected. So even if I'm talking about pre-Gaur Purnim lectures, I can be talking like I will do today about having a faith crisis and how to navigate it. And that's not totally disconnected from each other. So that's a topic that, in this case, Komal Kumari requested today, and I can really resonate with her request, not only in terms of measuring the pulse of local communities, but also having myself gone through some interesting chapters in my life, which gave me some scars. Or samskars, as you prefer to put it. You use the Sanskrit is samskars. In English, we say samskars. So I've gone through some of that in connection to the topic. So I think I also try to put my testimony in the service of the faith of others, even if that testimony entails my own faith crisis. So today the title for today's lecture is Surviving the Storm. And the subtitle is Navigating Faith Crisis with Grace and Resilience. So this is an important topic because, I mean, the whole journey of bhakti begins with faith, in general words. So I'm beginning today my series of lectures talking about faith, through which everything begins, and faith crisis, which somehow is part of the faith journey. As we will see, it's not possible to embrace a faith journey without faith crisis. So already I'm giving you a trailer of which will be one of my main points today, which is let's normalize crisis. Let's not just pray for them endlessly, but let's normalize them when they come. And that will help us to address them from a more holistic perspective, so to say. And faith crisis, as we will see also, for me, is not the opposite of faith. It's not a faith crisis, but faith crisis is an aspect of faith, an aspect of the faith journey. And this is also a topic that I've considerably touched upon in my recent book, I mean, last book last year, Radical Personalism, especially in one chapter called Issues and Tissues Between Guru and Disciple. And I just clarify one more time, although I did it a few times, when I put tissues in my title, I was not referring to this paper that you use to wash out your tears, although it may apply. But tissues I refer to like layers, right? It's a tissue. So different layers of issues many times may happen in the connection between guru and disciple or beyond guru and disciple, of course. A faith crisis is not limited to that for sure. But that's one of the main scenarios where that can happen from one direction or the other. So my book, Radical Personalism, is not officially 108% about the faith crisis, but somehow it has been triggered. The original inspiration came by a certain series of chapters in my own life that I will connect with to a faith crisis. to the point of, as you may know, I ended up asking not so much whether I continue or not as a devotee, but how to continue as a devotee. The idea of continuing was no doubt about that. But how to continue, that was a big question. And I'm sure that I won't ask that question. That was not the last time I had asked that question. I may ask that question. I may have to ask that question a few more times in this lifetime. No? I think that's, again, you can call that a faith crisis, or you can call it a moment of introspection about how to proceed with further awareness and depth. How to continue as a devotee. I can no longer continue in this particular way. If you want to call that a faith crisis, I'm okay. But that's an important question we have to ask ourselves a few times, probably. So today I also may share a few sections from radical personalism in connection to this topic. But today, in connection to faith crisis, I want to mostly address the theme from three main angles. First of all, to define what's a crisis, because sometimes we start talking about the crisis, but we have not stopped to define what we are talking about. And maybe each of us have a different idea about the word, and that creates a big difference in the final outcome. So we'll try to define what's a crisis, and trying to understand that the crisis, again, is not ontologically negative. Then why a crisis is a crisis, why we experience a crisis as such. And third, how to navigate a crisis without drowning. Since we use the navigation analogy, how to navigate successfully onto the other shore, so to say, till we reach the next crisis and we continue growing. But mostly I will spend some time trying to address what's a crisis and trying to properly define crisis. Since I think that when we have the proper conception of things, it's way more easier to find whatever solution we need to find. Like I always recall, and I quoted that in my book, this idea that Albert Einstein, he said, if I have 60 minutes to solve a problem, I will spend 55 minutes trying to understand the problem and then 5 minutes solving it. First, I need to get a grasp of what's the actual problem about, because sometimes the actual problem is that I don't understand which is the real problem, and I end up addressing something which is not the problem, and that's the problem, and it never solves. So first of all, let's begin by trying to get some proper conception of what's a crisis. No? What do we understand by that word? And also, as I say, trying to normalize crisis. Because let's be honest, life is made of crisis. Even before talking in terms of devotional life, I don't know. In one sense, going out of the womb, it's in itself a crisis of its own sort. No? As a child, we have our own crisis. I don't think you will tell me there was none. No? Then being a teenager is in itself crisis personified, basically, from tip to toe. Then you have middle life crisis, when you're in your 40s and I'm not fully satisfied with my life, what I have done, what to do now. Then come later age crisis, and you name it, crisis, crisis, crisis. But in one sense, one crisis allows us to reach the other crisis, to reach the next shore, the next stage. So there is a way to think of our progress in terms of crisis. So we can tie the notion of crisis to some form of progress. And we can apply the same aging periods, childhood, birth, and so on, to devotional life, which has its own development as well. You can be in your devotional kindergarten, in your just living the devotional womb, learning to crawl, learning to walk, learning to speak, learning to think, learning to fall, learning to stand up again, and so on. So, and each of these devotional ages, so to say, also have their own crisis. Human life is a crisis. I mean, human life is an existential crisis to be solved. That's basically what's human experience. Atato Brahma Jignasa, that's how the Vedanta Sutra begins. Indirectly it's saying, welcome to human life, an existential crisis to be solved. That's what it says in contemporary language. That's my contemporary translation of Sutra number one. Atato Brahma Jignasa. Atato, now you are a human, Brahma Jignasa. You have to inquire about the Absolute. You have to solve the riddle of life. Life, like a problem to be solved. Not like a problem, like in a bad word. It's a problem, like mathematical problem. You have to solve the problem. So human existence is that. It's an existential crisis. And again, it's not a bad word. Remember that point. It's a puzzle to solve constantly. That's how we can measure progress. Like Bhakti Rakshak Siddhartha Goswami will say, he will describe progress as embracing a higher conception of reality and let it go of a lower conception. And then again, embracing a yet higher conception and let it go on that lower conception. Bhaktivinoda Thakur, in his famous Bhagavad speech, he will say, today's perfection is tomorrow's imperfection. No. Thus indicating the ongoing progressive nature of things. So if you want, again, to depict that from going to from one crisis to the other, there is place for that, no problem. So since, again, human experience is in itself an existential crisis, who I am and how to respond to that question in so many ways, because that question is not so easy to reply. Maybe you can say, I know how to reply to that one, Maharaj. I'm spirit soul, I'm not this body. That's the official one-liner, but you have to find your own, and I'm not against that one-liner, but you have to find your own way to reply to that question and to walk that talk as well. And in time, we may need to ask that question over and over and over again. Do you think that when Sanatana Goswami approached Mahaprabhu and asked him, who am I? That who am I came from the same place that we may ask, who am I now? No, that's a very different who am I. And that evokes a very particular reply in return. But again, my point is that this crisis that human life is an embodiment of is not something bad. So let's normalize crisis, because sometimes Gaudiya Vaishnavas are very good at stigmatizing those things that we should be normalizing. We have that particular talent. We end up stigmatizing many things that actually should be normalized. And at one point, if you don't have a proper balance for that, you end up stigmatizing almost everything. Everything is stigmatizable, basically. And we need to normalize, to humanize so many aspects of our life. So a faith crisis is not something necessarily unnecessary. In other words, we need to go through them. And for that, let me define what crisis means. And I already mentioned, I'm sorry, many of you, if you have heard some of my lectures, you may feel, okay, Maharaj is kind of obsessed with defining words sometimes. He has some problem there. He has some unresolved childhood trauma with glossary and alphabets. I don't know, maybe his parents failed at that. I mean, there was no dictionary at his house, and or there were too many, you know. But no, that's not the case. I might have my own childhood trauma to solve for sure, like everyone. But in this case, I think it's very important that we learn to know what's the meaning of the words we use, especially the original meaning of the words we use. Because sometimes words adopt certain meaning through the millennia and lost the original meaning they were intended for. So if we don't have a proper language for something, we cannot talk about it. I remember when we gave some months ago a talk on abuse, another topic, but related, and abuse and how we need to be able to name and frame different forms of abuse, because if I'm not able to name and frame them, I'm not able to acknowledge them when they are going on, because I don't have a language to to point to them. So I can I cannot talk about that because I don't have the language to point to that reality. So in the same way, if I don't have a language for something, I cannot talk about it. If I don't have a proper language, accurate definition of words, I cannot talk about those things properly. If I define crisis in the wrong way, I may talk about crisis, but inaccurately, not for what the crisis is actually about. So let me share a few lines from my book when I speak about crisis and try to define that. This is from Radical Personalism. So, and I'm going through my own crisis here with the insects, as you can see. So that's a good way of walking my talk. No, I'm not asking any subliminal help. I'm just committing myself to walk my talk, all that it takes. It's no problem. So you will hear my definition of crisis. I shouldn't be complaining about this. It says like this: a crisis is created, an opportunity to shake loose the confines of normalcy. The very word crisis refers to a decisive point and not to something that shouldn't be happening. Therefore, if a crisis is properly appreciated for what it is, then such a crisis won't represent any breakdown, but an essential breakthrough. So what I quote in my book is the actual definition meaning of the word crisis. The word crisis means, originally speaking, decision. That's the meaning of crisis, interestingly. Decision, a situation where you have to take a decision. Decisive point. That's crisis. I won't say anything for a few seconds so you can ruminate on that. You can stay with it. And you can compare notes from what's crisis for you, for us normally, and what crisis actually mean. No? Decisive point. That's crisis. That's the meaning of the word. That's intention. That's intention of what we call crisis. So that's what the crisis is, decision. In other words, taking responsibility in your life, taking responsibility for your life. Because taking responsibility in our life means taking responsibility for our life. Crisis is not so much a problem that shouldn't be happening, or crisis is not so much something that I'm going through because other person did such and such a thing that happened to me. No, crisis means, yeah, something may have happened outside of me, as it happened every time, but that impels me internally to take some stance, to take a decision. That's crisis. The whole purpose of whatever happens to us, as crisis-like as we may feel it, is for us to take a decision, to take a stance, to take responsibility. And that may be unsettling. And that may be terrifying. And that may be why we relate sometimes crisis to something negative, to something that I will prefer to avoid if I can. Sometimes that has more to do with the fact of taking a stance, responsibility, and so on and so forth. So no, crisis is not a breakdown. As I put in my book, crisis is a potential breakthrough. And generally our main breakthrough will come through breakdowns. Okay. I'll try to walk my talk as much as I can. Oh, I trust. So ideally a crisis doesn't end in the breakdown part, but it has to take us to the breakthrough. Because as I also describe, crisis is an opportunity to shake loose the confines of normalcy. Generally, we are quite habituated to inhabit normalcy, what we call normalcy, of course. Normalcy means generally those things that remain in my comfort zone, those things that are full of certainty, full of order, full of predictability. That's normal. Don't bring any abnormal stuff here, please. But sometimes we need that when order becomes excessive, when we start to become addicted to certainty, then we need those confines of normalcy to be shattered on some level. On some level. And that's when life happens then to us. And as I mentioned in my book, Krishna comes to us in the form of our life. That's one of the ways Krishna visits you on a daily basis. No need to hear a flute or to see some blue guy descending from somewhere. Just pay attention to your life, daily life circumstances. That's Krishna knocking on your door. That's Krishna coming to you as an uninvited guest. And as they say in India, Atithi Devo Bhavan. You should treat an uninvited guest as God himself. So what if God himself is the uninvited guest? How much you should welcome that person and you should be a good host. The point is that that guest will knock the door, but will come with the intention of shaking loose the confines of your normalcy. Because Krishna wants us to grow. Krishna wants us to love him. And for that, we need to be willing to coexist with some degree of uncertainty, with some degree of chaos, with some degree of things out of control. Basically, we need to accept how reality operates. It's not that things are not out of control, out of our control. There are, but we have a big problem acknowledging that. So some situation will come to overtly show you you're not in control here. Someone else is, and that's beautiful. Those are some of the moments of great breakthrough. When the moments you've suffered the most and the moments you love the most, probably those are the moments that you receive the profound teachings in your life. Moments of great love, moments of great pain. The two of them are equally crucial. The two of them balance each other, complement each other. They are not antithesis of each other. It's not that I will like just one, only great love. The point is that great love entails great pain. If you play out the implications of the equation, you cannot get one without another. That's why also I try to also tell devotees every time, okay, you want to go to Golok Vrindavan, you want to serve Sri Sri Radha and Krishna, be careful of having become like a happiness addict, because there's pain there also. I mean, if you learn the descriptions of Sri Radha and her pain, which is incomparable to all the other pain of the three worlds put together, you may get scared and intimidated about going to Golok Vrindavan. You may feel like, I thought I was supposed to stop suffering. No. I subscribe for demigod worship from tomorrow on, and I will have a great time with Indra and all the guys in heaven. What's the thing of all the suffering of Sri Radha is greater than all the three worlds? But what's that going on? But it's a pain in the context of love. That's the important thing. We are never saying no more pain. We are saying no more loveless pain. Let me add that important word. When love is there, pain is loving, because it's in the context of love. Therefore, pain is sweet. Pain is constructive. Pain is nourishing. And I'm not being a masochist here by saying all these things. I'm not promoting something like that. So I'm saying this because we have to make peace with pain. It's not that we should stop suffering. We have to learn how to suffer. Compassion is pain, and it's love, and so on. So again, my point is that both great love and great pain open our heart like nothing else in life. And generally, one takes to the other, great pain to great love, and each will bring their own crisis, if you will. But as long as we are willing to change and grow, that's fine. That's perfect. In other words, if there is no great pain or no great love, there's no great learning. So therefore, if there's no crisis, probably there is no much learning either. If we are not being put to test deeply in life and we are not entering to that arena, we may end up in a very shallow version of ourselves. And it's a version that we won't be satisfied with ourselves. What speak others? And that's what our great scriptures are trying to teach us. I mean, go to the Bhagavad Gita, go to the Bhagavatam. I mean, the two of them start in full crisis scenario. It's not that Arjuna is in his comfort zone and Parikshit Maharaj is having a jacuzzi, drinking a whatever, a juice. I mean, they are in full-blown crisis. Try to empathize with their situation. Try to enter the space where they're in. Try to see yourself in a battlefield with all your family members on the other side of the team, not on your team. And you know what's next. I mean, that's kind of unimaginable. Such a crisis. That's the first chapter of the Gita, Vishada Yoga, which is Arjuna acknowledging his crisis. Then the rest unfolds. But the first chapter is acknowledge your crisis. Acknowledge you're in crisis. Then we can talk about transcendence and all that cool esoteric stuff. But first be grounded into your crisis and acknowledge you are going through one and you are throwing your Gandiva and crying like a baby and rolling on the ground and being completely disempowered and afraid and neurotic. First that one. First chapter one of the Gita. Some people, chapter one is not too much. Let's go to the second one. That's the official beginning. You skip first chapter, you get the whole Gita out of context. You miss the whole point of that. You may use the Bhagavad Gita as an evasive tool, not to go through the first chapter of Vishada, of lamentation, acknowledging your messy emotions, your crisis, and so on and so forth. And that, in part, was a preliminary foundation that helped Arjuna to strongly, realistically say to Krishna, the second chapter, Sisyastiham Sarnam Tvam Prapanam, I'm surrendering to you, I'm your disciple. But first he had to go through all these other layers. So the Bhagavatam, the same thing. Parikshit Maharaj, I mean, imagine I tell you now, you have a 1 week, just 1 week more. And that's a crisis in itself. You are thrown into a new portal. You won't see reality the same way, never again. So that's the beginning of our most important books, which basically means you want to enter into the spirit of these works, you have to go somehow through some similar thing so you can connect with the narrative. Because if not, it's just like an interesting old story, but how much it is relatable to your own life. These books are to be lived in. I mean, as sometimes it is said, in each one of these books, there is a blank page for us to fill it with our own life story. It's not just the story of the gopis and Parikshit Maharaj and Ambarish Maharaj. It's also the story of all of you, Bindu Madhava and Narayan and everyone. But for us to enter into that story, we have to have our own story to present. So crises are very connected to this. Crises are connected to birth and death. And not necessarily only physical birth and death, but the death that we need to go through to attain a new birth, to be reborn. Second born Christians, second born Gaudias, third born, fourth born. I mean, I lose count how many times it happened in this lifetime only. So many times we need to die to be reborn. Every day, technically speaking, many times per day, we may need to die to all conceptions, to all versions of ourselves, to all myths of what we think Krishna consciousness was about, be willing to rediscover our own tradition. Never be so sure, never take Krishna consciousness for granted. The nature of Krishna Bhakti is ever evolving. So Krishna Bhakti has become something else in the next minute. There's a new version of it to download, so to say. And that's sadhana on a daily basis. Sadhana on a daily basis, I will tune in and connect so I can download the latest version, so I remain, so Krishna Bhakti, or so I do not become obsolete to Krishna Bhakti, so to say. Krishna Bhakti is never obsolete, but I need to be updated and upgraded to keep the pace of transcendence to keep the pace of Krishna Bhakti. So again, all this can be perceived as a crisis. I have to let go of certain ideas, especially ideas. Now, if there is something we are addicted to, it's our ideas. Maybe none of you are addicted to any substance or stuff of that type. But if there is something we all share, an addiction, we are addicted to our thoughts about things. No? Like I was reading some time ago some research they did, and they say on a very nice day, bear that in mind, people is willing to reconsider their thoughts. How much? 5% of them. And that's on a nice day, on a sunny weekend, holiday day. 5% of my thoughts, I'm willing to revisit them, which basically means almost none of them I'm willing to revisit as an average. So that may be, my point is, we may feel that as a death, no? To change my mind, to change my patterns, to change my perspective, to change my angle of vision. Although interestingly, that's what spiritual life should be about from day one. We are coming here to change, to be transformed, to be whatever, to become someone new. So crisis, we may feel a crisis in these moments, no? Letting go of ideas, sometimes letting go of circumstances, sometimes letting go of people, and so on and so forth, to arrive to a new territory that we may need to arrive. In science, they say science progresses one funeral at a time. Maybe you heard that one. Or we could say here, in spiritual life, we progress one crisis at a time, which is a form of funeral also. You have to die to something to be born to something else. So I'm saying all this. I'm sorry if it feels I'm pounding the post too much. No, you may feel Maharaj, the post is already pounded. Stop the stuna nika nana nyaya, this logic of pounding the post. No? But the point is, we need crisis. Okay, I'm not saying let's organize a movement to promote as much crisis as we can. I'm not saying that. I'm just saying we need them. So when they come without us calling for them, let's welcome them. For some reason, they are coming. Now, not force them masochistically, but let's learn to normalize them. They need to happen. And I'm saying that because sometimes we haven't reached that point where we really are at peace with the idea crises need to happen. Even if I don't have a clue why they're happening, at least to have this foundational trust. For some reason, this is happening. And again, remember, crisis is not so much what happens to us, but our perception of things, ultimately. If you want to take crisis as something negative, that's our filtering. But crisis is, this is a point, something that invites us to take a stance. Something that throws us outside of the normal. Something that demands a new paradigm shift. Therefore, the dying of two old patterns, two old views. And it feels like death, I know. And something that demands that we take responsibility for ourselves. Because if we don't learn to take responsibility, we cannot love. Because love is a voluntary decision that I take, fully responsible in relation to other person. So if we want to love Krishna, that's the most responsible decision we can ever take. So we have to be gradually cooked to be ready to take that step fully. So some micro loving situations will come. I mean, they're fully loving, but we take them micro doses in the beginning to take responsibility, So it's interesting because a crisis is, again, something that puts us outside of the normal, inviting us to die to old patterns, demanding responsibility. And because of all that, we feel a crisis as something negative. Because many times we are not willing to that. We are not willing to change our mind, leave our comfort zone, take responsibility. And that's what creates the actual problem. Our unwillingness to embrace that. If we are willing, there is no problem. Crisis will be just enlightened. And you maybe even at one point become, will be praying for them. That's how I take Kunti's prayer to Krishna. When she's asking Krishna, send me more problems. It's not that she has some dysfunctionality there. Why is she asking more problems? I mean, if you study her life, she had some problems. She had a good list of that. Nobody can compare with her lifestyle. And it's on top of that, she's asking for more. No? But actually, I will say she's asking for, because she's saying the more these things come, Bhavato Darshanam Yatsya, the more I'm having your darshan, the more problems I see, the more I see you in the problem. So the more I see you in the problem, how much I can call that problem problem. If a problem gives me your darshan, how I can call that a problem? So actually, Kunti is begging for further darshan of Krishna, which comes in the form of crisis, so to say. But she's expert in translating crisis as darshan. So that's the art we are trying to learn here, how to translate crisis into darshan, how to see Krishna's hand in behind what we may call a crisis. Again, crisis means decision. This is decisive point. This situation is inviting me to increase my decision-making in the direction of divine shelter. At the end of the day, every single situation in your life boils down to that. Whatever happens to you, ideally has the intention of us to increase our decision-making in the direction of further shelter, further trust, further confidence. So a few words on what's a crisis, and of course, what's a faith crisis. And today I'm just sharing one perspective. Please don't think that I'm giving just the final word on this topic. We could talk about this from so many angles. But the faith crisis, again, if crisis means a decisive point, faith crisis means a situation that is making my faith. What's faith? I have to define faith first. Because a faith crisis is not something like, okay, I was believing something and now that showed not to be true. Because that's a belief. But faith is something different. Faith has to do with something that I have experienced. But then comes another experience which somehow clashes with my previous experience. So, and that throws me into an unusual territory. So that's even more intense. Because we had some experience with some person or with the practice, but then we have some other experience or some lack of experience. I'm not feeling anything. I'm uninspired. I'm whatever. And that's called faith crisis, which again, faith crisis doesn't mean there's no longer faith. Faith crisis doesn't mean Krishna has disappeared. He's angry with you, so he left you alone. So he's chastising you for being so whatever. I mean, unless you are not a very good boy or girl, but I don't think you look very nice, all of you. So I don't think that's the case. But many times, again, faith crisis is just I'm being invited to reconceive what's faith. And the usual lens through which I approach faith no longer work. It doesn't mean there's no longer faith. It's just I need to learn a new faith language on this level, basically. Faith is wanting to express itself on another level, and I have to be up to that level to understand the language, so to say. Like when sometimes one may feel, oh, Krishna has disappeared from my life. And actually, he's getting closer. But he's so close that you lost sight of him. And you feel that he disappeared. Because you were accustomed to see Krishna there, and now he's here. But you insist on him appearing in the usual spot. But he's no longer in that usual spot. He's getting more close and intimate. But you got attached to seeing him from that perspective. So you have to let go of that attachment of Krishna appearing from that spot and realizing he may be closer. It's not that he disappeared. It's just that he's closer. And I have to stop conditioning his appearance in certain way from certain place. Mm-hmm. So faith crisis may be similar. Mm-hmm. The way we used to conceive Krishna consciousness may no longer work. It's not that Krishna consciousness no longer works. It's just that our particular version or filters through which we conceive Krishna consciousness became obsolete. You need to download the latest version. So Krishna consciousness doesn't feel obsolete to you. But we need to keep downloading those versions on a daily basis. That's sadhana. If not, Krishna consciousness became upgraded to the, whatever, 108.0 version, and we are in the 1.2 version, and there's a gap there. No? So we need to keep that pace. So let's go to the second part. We shared a few words on what's the meaning of crisis, trying to define crisis. Hopefully that became clear. Crisis means this is a point decision. It's not something bad. So why a crisis is a crisis? Why we perceive crisis, this is a point, as crisis, apocalypsis. Because again, for many of us, crisis means something bad, something wrong, something avoidable. Mm-hmm. Someone needs, I'm not using it, so I leave it there. So, so this is very much like trauma, no? Trauma is an important word, but also trauma is an important word to define. Trauma is not what happens to us. Trauma is what happens inside of us as a result of what has happened to us. See you tomorrow for lunch. So trauma is not what has happened to us outside, but it's what's happening to us inside as a result of what's happened to us. For some people, the bike is broken, and that's trauma. And for, like Archana Siddhi was given the example yesterday. She gave the other example, right? Prahlad Maharaj. You study Prahlad Maharaj's experience with his father, Hiranyakashipu, and you will feel, oh my gosh, this child, he's ready for, therapy for 3 decades minimum. With that father, with all that he went through from birth to 5 years, he will be a totally traumatized boy. But no, he was fine. do you follow my point? So many things happened to him on the outside, but what happened inside of him was very different. So he was so absorbed and connected that he was not traumatized by having an Hiranyakashipu as his father. Sometimes we may not have Hiranyakashipu. We have our own father, parents, and we have our own dose of trauma because of not being able to process some situations which were not as extreme. So the same happens with crisis. And crisis is not so much what happens to us outside, but what happens to us inside as a result of what happened to us on the outside. And with this, I don't want to sound, of course, indifferent or insensitive. I imagine many of us, or probably all of us, or most of us, have gone through some pretty intense stuff on the outside. I myself include myself in the list, so I'm not outside of that list. So it's not my intention to downplay and reduce it to mere, that was your karmic debt. No? And it's up to you to read that internally with the proper lens. No? So I don't want to be cheaply speaking about that. For those of you who may know, recently we have inaugurated something called Tadatmya Sangha, which is all about Tadatmya. No? And Tadatmya means empathy. No? So I personally, we don't want to promote the opposite of that. We want to promote sensitivity and connectiveness, not evasiveness, not indifference, not cruelty, when relating to others' trauma, on the contrary. So the question remains, when something happens and we perceive it as a crisis, why, as a crisis in the negative sense, not like a decisive point, but as a crisis in the, again, apocalypses. Why? Why do we perceive them as such? Give me some few ideas. Let's do some brainstorming together. Scared to change. Okay. What else? Have my water break meanwhile. Fear of the unknown. Yeah. Okay, particular situation represents like a big threat to our ego's existence. That was nicely depicted, thank you. Yes.
Something that we want or attached to is being taken away.
Okay, something we are attached to is being taken away. Pranada?
Just when I was drawing it away.
That's so nicely. Yes, I agree. Anyhow, all that is correct and so many more things, but that's kind of the base situation, no? And I'm saying that also to be compassionate with ourselves, so to say, in the sense of it may be embarrassing to acknowledge all these reasons in ourselves. That's one of the most painful things that can happen, to acknowledge my own fears, my own attachments, my own fragility, my own, as Kumari was saying, fear of the unknown, which in one sense also it's fear of nothingness. Because in the known, we have something at least. No? I have my sense of identity. I have my some perimeter to exist, to be. And if I'm just venturing into the unknown, it's potential nothingness. No? I mean, that's what faith is. Faith, in one sense, implies some type of leap. In which you are jumping into something that, I don't know, it sounds risky, but I trust that I will be found there, actually. My actual being will be found there, and I won't end up in nothingness with no identity whatsoever, because that can be a neurosis for everyone. So nobody can live without an identity, basically. So I'm saying all this so we also have some self-compassion in understanding why we are not so willing sometimes to make the quantum leap of faith into the unknown and are totally successful in navigating every single crisis. No. So I'm not giving all this lecture so after the class we are start to beat up on one another for failing miserably at our faith crisis and so, but also how hopefully to learn to navigate that with sustainability and understanding and compassion and so on and so forth. No, so yeah, I remember in my own personal case, although I won't torture you with my unauthorized biography, basically, but going through a few of these faith crises, that was very interesting because I was literally thrown into that space of questioning who I am from scratch again. You know, who I am as a practitioner, as a disciple, as a member of a community that I was no longer member. So I'm member of what now? Where do I belong? Who am I? And how to continue, as I mentioned. How to continue, as I mentioned in my book, how to continue belonging and not merely fitting in. I don't want to fit into Krishna Bhakti. I want to belong. And for belonging, I need to be myself. And to be myself, I need to know who I am, at least on some level. Because fitting in doesn't require you to have faith. It's just like a performance, so to say. But real belonging, you know, that requires some more deeper ingredients. Oh, thank you. So why we feel faith crisis, again, as we mentioned, sometimes faith crisis also can come from not only because of a situation of abuse or betrayal. That can happen. That has happened. That keeps happening, unfortunately. And that's a complex scenario. How to keep trusting without becoming a cynic when betrayal has been there. how not to jump from being naive to being a cynic. Because generally, the people who is the most naive and idealistic are the ones who end up being the most cynical at the end. They jump from one extreme to the other. And of course, both of them are two sides of the same coin. So we want to be discerning in the middle point. We want to remain open to trust, although our trust will be informed by trauma, probably, by suffering, by pain, by some scars, literally. Sometimes we may have a faith crisis because we just feel that we don't feel. Sometimes devotees come to me telling me that, Maharaj, I don't feel anything when chanting. But we have to always start with some good place, which is you feel that you don't feel. So you feel something. You feel that you don't feel anything. So that's feeling something. I mean, let's begin on a positive note. From that foundation, we construct something more. I don't want to say you stay there forever, but acknowledge that you are feeling something. Then why we are not feeling, or probably sometimes again, I've seen that so many times. They were just thinking, I'm not feeling anything, or I'm not feeling what I'm supposed to feel. And that I'm supposed to feel entails a hyper-idealization of what should be the experience they should be having. And maybe they are comparing themselves with Raghunath Das Goswami or some very, very advanced example. So that's an important thing to acknowledge. I'm not feeling what I should be feeling. Have you gone through the first chapter of the Gita again, Bishada Yoga, the yoga of disappointment and suffering? Maybe you have to feel a few of those things first before trying to roll on the ground and cry tears of ecstasy like the Goswamis did. So that's also a point. Let's be careful with how we idealize what we should be feeling. And let's be honest about where we are. That's the most, even we may find that's the most embarrassing thing to acknowledge where I am. The Bhagavatam say that's the most beautiful and virtuous thing. Saguna parikirtita. To acknowledge where you are at present, that's real virtue. To not do that, that's the opposite of virtue. That's escapism. That's evasiveness. That's Krishna unconsciousness. That's not Krishna consciousness. So be careful of using Krishna consciousness to promote Krishna unconsciousness. We can use the spiritual life to stop practicing spiritual life. That's one of the best ways of not practicing spiritual life, to adorn yourself with all the external paraphernalia of spiritual life. So nobody has to tell you anything, but internally, nothing's going on. But you have the right words to say, you know how to reply to each question, so you have covered all the bases. So nobody can tell you anything. But at night, you are not at peace with your pillow, basically. Because you know you are betraying yourself. You are not living up to your highest potential. And also we may have crisis because of, I don't know, so many things, no? Social dynamics or sometimes awkward philosophical presentations that do not resound with us, and we feel I'm supposed to swallow that. No, I mean, it doesn't resound, doesn't make sense. Or some primitive stances towards certain life situations that we feel that this requires update. No, this is like the from Paleolithic age or something. It's not relatable. No, so whatever the case, crisis, which again means decision. No? Those situations that I don't feel connected with are inviting me to take a decision, take a stance. You have to do something about it. And again, this may be scary. Although it may sound contradictory, but most people is terrified about freedom. Let's be honest. Most people want to be told what to do, how to think, and that's it. How to be a good boy, follow that cue, look in that direction. Don't go outside of the norm. But we need to step outside of the norm. Interestingly, that's another meaning of a word. The original meaning of the word ecstasy means stepping outside of the norm. So you want ecstasy? That's the first version of it you need to embrace. Ecstasy. Now, stasis has to do more with static, with statu quo, with something, the norm. And ecstasy means step outside of the norm. Again, break loose of the confines of normalcy. It's connected to today's topic. But again, sometimes on a lib level, we say freedom kijai, lib level freedom. But many times it's easier, quote unquote, easier. It's not easier, but it sounds easier to be told what to do, how to think. And there's a place for that in the beginning, in our kindergarten version of bhakti. We need, okay, do this, do that, walk there, your head to the ground in this moment. Don't do this. That's it. I have my magical formula of success. But in time, you start to realize, wow, life is more complicated than this. It's more nuanced. It's not black and white. It's multicolor and it's layered. And I'm not the same as him and her. And I have to think for myself. I may be mistaken, and I will be wrong, and I have to learn from my mistake. Oh, this is a mess. Life is a mess. But as the saying says in your country, God bless this mess. I read that one the other day. I was like, yes, God bless this. I felt some hope when I read that quote, basically. Okay, there's a place for me. Because freedom, again, having freedom means take responsibility for your actions. For whatever you think, for your potential mistakes, it's okay. Surrender necessitates freedom. Surrender doesn't mean I'm no longer free, I surrender. No, you have to be fully free so you can surrender with full choice, with full voluntary decision. I surrender. That's surrender. If not, we can use the shape of surrender to not surrender. You can use the disguise of surrender, not like more the mudra, to avoid any actual substantial free voluntary surrender. And that's impersonalism, basically. Not taking personal responsibility for all that I can be. That's a way of not being all the person you can. And that I frame it in radical personalism as impersonalism. And I remember Purnachandra Swami, he wrote this very interesting book, just recommended, Unspoken Obstacles on the Path to Bhakti. That's very interesting. He wrote that book like 30 years ago or something. That was pretty foreshadowing a few issues. And he will say, some people choose to merge themselves into Brahman. No? We have the official mergers, the philosophically official mergers, the jnanis who say, I want to go there, so to say, aham brahmasmi, and there I'm going. And we have those who prefer to merge into an institution and to become one more face into the crowd without an individual opinion. And they are hiding in the crowd. That's another form of impersonalism, he will say, like institutional merging. No. Like I just squeeze myself into the whole mass, homogeneous mass of things, of people, and I lose my voice and my criterion and my individuality, and I don't have to think for myself, and I'm just carried by the waves of whatever. And he'll say, that's another form of Mayavad. No. We are very strong against Mayavad, but we may be also very experts at canvassing that disguised in the packaging of personalism. So that's even more dangerous. Because if someone says overtly, I'm impersonalist, I'm all for it. So, okay, I value your honesty. But if we speak about personalism but promote the opposite, that can create a very tricky short-circuiting, so to say. Let me share a few words about freedom in connection to this, quoting something that Prabhupada said. He says like this. Srila Prabhupada, the famous Vaishnava world ambassador, has repeatedly established the Gaudiya teaching of radical freedom through his own example of words, stating that his movement is meant to make people who are independently thoughtful, that in all spheres of devotional service, freedom is the main pivot, and that without freedom, there is no execution of devotional service. In fact, Sri Krishna himself concludes his immortal Bhagavad Gita by inviting his friend and student Arjuna to fully deliver it on the teaching he just received, and then do as you please. That's what Krishna tells Arjuna, do as you please. I'm not deciding for you. Spiritual life is to be performed out of our own volition, not out of fear or under oppression or intimidation, since the lotus flower of devotion will never grow in the lake of coercion, but only in the crystalline waters of freedom. So, anyhow, some thoughts in connection to why some we may feel a crisis as a crisis. There are a few more thoughts. How long I'm going? Sorry for that. Okay, 1 hour. Do we have a few more minutes to conclude? Okay. So, of course, crisis means to take a decision, and sometimes we may be in certain situations where we don't have a clue what decision to take. We may be willing to take a decision, but we may not know where to start. We may not know what's going on, why the crisis is happening. We may lack purpose in the situation, and that can be desperating when you don't find a purpose to what's going on. That's one of the worst things, following Viktor Frankl's idea. We need purpose to make reality bearable. So sometimes we need to stay with the situation time enough and pray sincerely so we can discover the purpose of the crisis and draw some meaning from that and make that nourishing eventually. We shouldn't create imagined purpose, but actually discover the actual purpose of what's going on. Also, sometimes it happens that we are in front of a crisis and we have decision to make. Again, crisis means decision. And we have an idea, okay, I will decide this. But also sometimes we are afraid of the consequence of taking the wrong decision. And then comes the idea of, well, you have to risk yourself to do that. No, it's not that you will always take the right decision. And even when you take the wrong decision, if you learn from your wrong decision, this was not the wrong decision at the end of the day. So if we are willing to learn, even the wrong decision becomes an acquired insight. And please don't care if some of your environment is judging you, like you are taking the wrong decision, you have done it wrong, you are independent, you are being a rebel, you are offensive, because sometimes these things happen also when you take decisions instead of letting everyone else decide for you. So again, it's important to own your crisis. And sometimes that entails taking decisions which have been wrong, but you learned your most important lessons by taking the wrong decision. So somehow you are happy that that happened in that way, so to say. And also a few tips that come to mind how to navigate the faith crisis in a way that we can survive it. Of course, as simple as that sounds to begin with, we have to acknowledge that we have a crisis. We have a situation that begs for a decisive point, because sometimes we may not be willing to acknowledge I'm going through a crisis. This is a crisis. This is inviting me to take a decision that sometimes can change my whole life. So for us to have healing, for us to have change, first we have to have recognition and acknowledgement of what's going on. Like Arjuna in the Gita, he acknowledged. In the beginning, he was not acknowledging. He was trying to find some other reasons to justify his behavior, and eventually he acknowledged, oh my gosh, no, I'm a mess. I'm through a crisis. I don't know what to do. I'm completely lost. Krishna, help me. Okay? So healing could come. But first was acknowledgement of the mess, so to say, right? And also, when we are acknowledging our crisis, try to do so acknowledging a crisis is a very vulnerable moment. No? You will be just stripped naked internally and showing yourself in utmost vulnerability. So you have to surround yourself by people who can accompany you in those moments, who know how to honor your vulnerability, who will listen to you with full acceptance and non-judgmental mind, and accepting you in your crisis moment fully. And listening, again, listening is not so easy. Sometimes we think listening is easy. Sometimes listening means listening without saying anything, just listening, without advising, without judging, without preaching, without schooling the other person, without even sympathizing or tranquilizing the other person, just listening. Just be there for the person. Then you will need to do all the other things. But first, you have to just listen to allow the other person to empty himself, herself out without analyzing, without interpreting, without threatening, of course, without doing an interrogation, just fully present to receive the other person. We need that type of people through our crisis moments. Mm-hmm. That's Sadhu Sangha. I will call that Sadhu Sangha, basically. Mm-hmm. And crises are always way more sailed when we are in good company. When we are in good company, then we can allow ourselves, and I can recall in my own crisis that I have been with some of you in a few years ago. And you need that safe space to be vulnerable. I mean, if you don't perceive it's a safe space, you cannot be vulnerable. And if you are not vulnerable, you are not acknowledging what you need to acknowledge. But when you are vulnerable, you can allow yourself, give permission to go through all the emotional ups and downs that you need to go in a crisis, for example. No? In the beginning, you may need to grieve and you may need to cry and you may need to suffer and be overwhelmed and be angry until eventually you reach a point of reconciliation and forgiving and healing and trusting that there is hope to open your heart again. And no matter the crisis, some personal advice, although you may choose to agree with that or not, but whatever has happened to our life, even if we have navigated betrayal, rejection, ostracizing, scapegoating, shunning, and stuff like that, let's be very mindful and careful not to become resentful, not to get stuck to the past, whether it's toxic nostalgia or hate. Because as they say, resentfulness is just like drinking a cup of poison and expect some other person to die. Oh, that's resentfulness. And that becomes a whole self-generating crisis of itself in another direction. And there will be always people supporting you in those patterns also. So we'll always find some audience to support us, whether we want to be hateful, whether we want to be forgiving. So anyhow, some words that I want to share today, a little spontaneous in terms of faith crisis, what's a crisis, some thoughts on how to navigate. Of course, I've kept it generic. Sorry if any of you are maybe going through a very specific faith crisis and you feel that's not being addressed, but that requires a personalized conversation. Here I am keeping it general, hoping that you may at least bring some point home. If that's happening, then today's presentation is a success. But the main idea is this: not let's try to see crisis as faith, not faith crushing, but faith renewing. And no matter how dark maybe the tunnel, there is really light at the end. And I don't want to sound like naive or like, oh yeah, I heard that one liner so many times, but that's true. That's really true. So no matter how, if you are caught in the eye of the storm today, or if you are not, you may be. All that is having a very deep purpose, very nourishing. And if we cannot see the bigger picture in that precise moment, let's be patient with mystery. That's another definition of faith, to be patient with mystery, to coexist with what we don't know, and to allow time to unfold. And Krishna is time personified, and he will show the bigger picture and the actual purpose of everything in our existence. So, and in that way, again, we normalize crisis and we get accustomed to dealing with these daily breakdowns and breakthrough. Imagine And that's my last point. Going back to Golok Vrindavan, our prospect in the eternal Lila on a daily basis, as I sometimes say it, I'm joking, but I'm not joking. Our service on a daily basis will be to save the lives of Radha and Krishna who are dying in separation from each other. That's the intensity of the necessity of service in the Lila. I mean, every single day, Radha and Krishna being separated by the dynamics of the Lila, and they are dying literally in separation from each other. And each of us have to be there to assist so they don't die. I mean, they will never die. That's the good news. But in the dynamic of the Lila, you will be giving your whole life to give them life, to give them hope. I mean, if that's not a crisis, I don't know how to call that. But that's a crisis that creates a breakthrough of further depth and love and charm in the Lila. So we are pointing to a very intense place. So better we get properly acquainted and prepare and train so we are able to navigate all these different life circumstances, again, with grace, with resilience, with commitment, and so on. So anyhow, some words I want to share today. Before concluding, I don't know if there's any question you may like to present, any comments, thoughts, something in connection to today's topic before we go for prasad and further sharing. Someone is commenting here, no pain, no gain. That's a famous quote here they use for a few things, right? Okay. Sorry? Yes.
It's a question in relation to the crisis. Crisis itself.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so to me, my perception is crisis is relative. It's relative. It's relative because some of you, in the sense that someone's going through something and, well, they're really making a mountain out of a molehill, you know, or that kind of thing. But, you know, okay. So in the light of crisis, my crisis, in other words, I am bewildered. I do not know what to do. I have no resources. I think that would be my experience in facing crisis.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what to do.
Mm-hmm.
So, are you presenting like a method for us simply because crisis will be there?
Mm-hmm.
And so are you presenting like a method break through rather than get knocked back, knocked over by it?
Mm-hmm.
Instead, break through. Is this my perception?
I hope so. I hope some of the words I shared may help as a method or as a way of navigating crisis. I'm not saying here's the method or there's the only way to do that. But I mean, for me, just to start defining crisis as a decisive point and all the things that we have shared is in itself a crucial part of the healing of the crisis, because when that comes, we are better equipped and informed to know what's actually going on here. And again, to gain acceptance, to normalize that this will happen, to normalize that we will be in moments that we don't know what's going on. I think that's also part of the method. Again, for me, method is not just I give you the magical formula so you have no more crisis, or the crisis will feel all nice and cozy. No, but just to share some tools, hopefully, or some life experience, mm-hmm. where or some living example, so to say, that, okay, I've gone through hell, and here I am back. No, and there's life after hell, so to say. No, I may not be crafting a particular method like how to, not how to avoid crises, because they are not avoidable. No? So how to embrace them properly, how to learn from them, how to see them as portals, as destiny points. That's for me the method, no? How to reframe our whole understanding of the world, and how to, as you were mentioning, I don't know what's going on. I don't know what to do. I think we need a lot of further education into staying in that place for more time. I mean, because sometimes we feel very uncomfortable when we, of course, and I can understand, when we don't know what to do and what's going on. It's kind of desperating. Desperating? Okay, you understand my point. I always create new words while talking, so sorry for that. But yeah, as I mentioned before, sometimes we get too addicted to certainty. So when something is uncertain, it starts to make us so nervous. And we need to develop the adhikar, the capacity to stay with uncertainty for some time. Stay there and trust. Not go crazy, of course, but learn, integrate, develop this paradoxical mind in which you can stay with uncertainty while increasing your trust and confidence. I don't need everything to be absolutely clear, unpredictable on the table for me to trust. That's a more shallow level of faith. I can be coexisting with things that overwhelm me, that I don't understand, that I may never understand fully, and it's okay. I don't need to solve the riddle. I can coexist with the riddle, as a mystery. You know, like the Christian mystics will say, mystery is not to be solved. We should preserve the mystery. No? So sometimes we are obsessed with solutions and clarification and certainty, but sometimes we have to be okay with questions and not answers. We want the answer quickly. And what if the answer is another question? We will get more nervous. No, another question? Yes, why not? The questions are bringing disclosure. Sometimes we are addicted to closure. No? So those things are favorable to propel Sharanagati also and surrendering, because what's the main expressions of surrender? To trust that Krishna is protecting me and to accept that he's maintaining me, especially Gopatri Dwaye Varanam. Krishna is maintaining me. And that's, of course, the idea is not just to say that when they are serving the Sunday feast. No, that's easy to say. No, oh, Krishna's maintaining me. Sweet rice ki jai. No? No, in the midst of uncertainty, in the midst of crisis, Krishna is maintaining me. When I don't have a clue what the hell is going on, Krishna is maintaining me. That I know. That's the point. I may not know anything else, but if there has to be that one certainty, no, that foundational certainty. Krishna loves me unconditionally. Krishna is maintaining me. Krishna is protecting me. Everything else, I don't have a clue what's going on. But that I know. So that will be more my methodology, if you will. In one sense, it doesn't bring a final closure to things, but it keeps them in constant disclosure and openness. But that's for me more healthy. Open systems, not closed systems, where things are like concluded, but open. That's what faith is about. That's a journey into the uncertain. And that's why we have defined faith as being patient with mystery, patient with the things that I do not understand fully, but I trust them.
Yeah.
Anyhow, some thoughts. I hope that helps. And as I mentioned in my book, in our particular Gaudiya Vaishnava tradition, we have so much information about everything. Our description of everything is so detailed that we may run the risk of becoming addicted to certainty. because we have answers for everything in ultra detail. So we may not be very expert at dealing with unknowing. So we want to know everything and every, I mean, you don't find any religious tradition that you will know which is the name of God's ankle bells. That's too specified. That's too much. And we got that info. And what's the names of Radha's earrings and all, everything is personified. Everything has a name. So we may be easily fall into this even like elitism and superiority complex. Like we know everything about everything. But when we are put into a situation where we has to not know what to do here, now it's like complicated. So we need to train ourselves into uncertainty. As I mentioned in my book, the opposite of faith is certainty. The opposite of faith is not doubt. Doubt is to nourish faith. We want a faith which is nourished by doubt, proper doubt, proper faith, proper doubt. But the opposite of faith is certainty. Faith has a lot to do with uncertainty, with coexisting with that in a proper way. And that's quite tied with what we are talking today, faith crisis and so on. Yeah. So other question or comments?
I have a comment. You mentioned crisis and also Dhruva Maharaj and Arjun. And I was just thinking of Radha and her separation. And it just seems to me, I wanted to know a little bit more the unknown in that context. It's like our human experience with God showing a context of where he's always been, some crisis in his vilas, it seems like. Mm-hmm. He's showing his human experience in a way, or he's revealing. Because I was wondering, like, how are these Leelas allegory, you know, going to be kind of representing a different light from what they are presenting when we see it? Like, what's the alternative? What's the deeper message? So the human experience, I was thinking like Krishna separated from his parents in the middle of the night. It's all crisis. It seems like a common theme, which we can reflect on those Leelas maybe. Because I was wondering, I was actually going to ask you, like, what are these allegories? And it's kind of like, it reveals like the experience of that human connection that he's saying is part of the process.
Krishna Lila is Nara Lila, and Nara Lila is fully human and fully divine. As I also like to mention in radical personalism, when Prabhupada says that Krishna Lila is human-like, doesn't mean that it's human-like. It's not human. It's human-like. No, it's fully human and fully divine. The like means fully divine. Human-like. Human, fully human, like, fully divine at the same time. It's not that it's pseudo-human. I mean, it's way more human than what we are human. So for us to enter into a fully human lila, we have to become fully human. And Krishna in his lila is fully human. It's fully vulnerable. I mean, sometimes we refer to God as Almighty. Almighty, but that says one half of the equation. The other half of the equation is all vulnerable. So Krishna is all vulnerable. In Vrindavan especially. He's defeated in wrestling on a daily basis, every single day. That's vulnerable. He's not winning. He's losing. Yashoda is tying him, chastising him. He's vulnerable. He's hit by the arrows of Cupid, by Radha and the gopis. He's vulnerable. I mean, that's the God we worship. That's a totally... And what to speak when Krishna wants to taste Radha Bhava's Mahaprabhu? That's another topic altogether we'll talk these days. But that's Krishna, his most vulnerable moment. No? So most human. Humanity is very connected with vulnerability. So... We worship a fully human, fully vulnerable God, and yeah, we are expected to be up to the occasion. So we have to be fully, that's a very big, powerful lesson from the Leela to each of us. When we read Krishna Leela, we should really read this full vulnerability that is present there and this full openness and exposition to crisis, in the particular crisis, you know, like, on a daily basis, and how willing they are to embrace that for the sake of love. I mean, that's like heroic. That's why Krishna is depicted in the classical drama terminology as a Nayaka, which is a hero. And I speak also about that in my book, that in classical aesthetics, in Rasa Shastra, the hero must be vulnerable. You cannot have a Nayaka who is not vulnerable. The hero must be vulnerable, affected by all these different emotions. If not, there is no drama. And if there is no drama and no hero, there is no Krishna Lila, basically. And the whole reality is over. So we need to keep those qualities, attributes, as they are in place. We need to properly honor and remind them ourselves. That's what it's all about, yeah. I mean, we worship a needy God. Let's be more literal. I mean, Krishna is in need. I mean, Krishna's Atmaram, he's self-satisfied, but in the context of Leela and in the experience of love, he's fully in need. He's fully dissatisfied, because the nature of love is it brings full satisfaction and it creates its own new level of thirst for more. So it's you can always have more. That's why the Leela is going on. If you will only have Atmaram, there is no Krishna Leela, because Krishna is self-satisfied. He doesn't need to do anything. That's why Vishnu in Vaikuntha, Narayan, that's God as self-satisfied. And that's why you never heard of Narayan Leela, because he doesn't need to do anything, because he's self-satisfied. He just sit and receive some foot massage. With all respect, I'm saying that, of course. No? But the point is, he's self-satisfied, so there's no need to do anything, because he's in his own Atma, he finds Ram, Atma Ram, he's self-satisfied. Krishna is not self-satisfied. I mean, he's self-satisfied, but on top of that, he's Pararam, in the words of Bhaktivinoda Thakur. He's divinely dissatisfied. And that keeps him running and thirsty for more love and engaging in all these types of Leela without sleeping at night, basically. So that's what we worship. That's my point, basically. And he has needs. And that creates our opportunity for service. No? The more needy our God, the more opportunities, the more service opportunities we will have. The more self-satisfied the face of God we worship, the less opportunities of service we have. That's why in Vaikuntha, there's Santa Rasa and just a little bit of Dasya. Because there's no need of more than that. Narayan is doing fine. But in Krishna is not doing fine. He needs so much service and assistance. He's so dissatisfied. So you have Santa, Dasya, Sakya, Vatsalya, Madhurya, and unending varieties of all of them. Because there's so much need for him to receive service. And that's our greatest blessing and opportunity we can offer ourselves in service to that. And when we reach Mahaprabhu, Gaur Leela, that's another conversation. How much in need Krishna is in trying to taste Radha Bhava, how much in need Radha is, Gadadhar Pandit, having given his heart to Krishna. Anyhow, that's for another conversation. You were raising your hand, sorry.
Yeah, so in the completely wrong and totally off base, but when we're here, when we're not in the spiritual realm, when we're here, is it like an accurate comparison or equivalent to say that our service is to make sure that we're uniting Krishna with all of his souls that he's needing and like desperately wanting to love and like, you know, he's experiencing this constant sadness, because he separated the souls who are here. Mm. So is that like the equivalent of
I will say there are many, of course, ways of conceiving this. I won't say there are just two ways. one, the one when you are there. So, and I'm sorry if I do like this, I don't want just to indicate it's in geographical upwards, Golok Vrindavan. It's just, it's not a physical movement, it's a movement in consciousness. But I wouldn't say it's just, there's two ways. Once you are there, that's how you serve. When we are here, that's how you serve. That neediness, there are no third option. There are many ways. The one you are proposing, it's one way. And that's, that very way can even be taken, explained or taken or conceived from many levels. To give you an example of that, for example, in Krishna Lila, and again, now I'm starting my trailer of the Gaur Lila classes. We are building up to Gaur Purnima, so what to do? Gaur Lila is eternal, but somehow the genesis of Gaur Lila has been traced back to Krishna Lila, in the sense of, in Krishna Lila, Krishna is witnessing the degree of love of the gopis and Sri Radha in particular, and he feels himself so moved by that and so indebted. You know? Krishna in the Gita says, Yatman Prabhadante, according to how you approach me, I reciprocate accordingly. He makes that famous statement in the Gita, which he contradicts in the Bhagavatam. The Bhagavatam, especially in the zenith of the Rasa Lila, chapter 32, 10th canto, verse 22, he's saying the opposite. Napariham nirabhadisam jyam sasadu kritam vibudhayasapiva, and so on. He's telling the gopis, I'm not able to repay your love. I cannot. And someone may say, but you say that in the Gita. Oh, that was the Gita. Here we are in another conversation. Here we're in the zenith of the Bhagavatam, and Krishna is saying, you love me so much and you give to yourself to me completely that I cannot give myself to you exclusively because I have so many other devotees. So I have to give myself to so many devotees, but you give yourself only to me and renounce everyone else for my sake. So I cannot do the same thing. I cannot renounce all my other devotees for your sake. You're renouncing everything. So I cannot repay you on a proper level. So I'm eternally in debt. But somehow or other, no, that's what Krishna says in that verse in the Gita. I'm in debt. I don't know how much the debt is. So what to speak of repaying the debt? I don't even have a clue how much do I owe you in terms of love. I cannot calculate the dimension of the debt. What to speak of repaying it? But that said, I have to do something about it. I cannot just remain relaxed and do nothing. So I'll try to pay back to you, and I will come. This is the famous verse that Sanatana Goswami interprets as, here Krishna is describing Gaur avatar. He will come as Mahaprabhu. He says, once in a day of Brahma, I will come as a sadhu, as a devotee, and will try to preach your glories, the glories of your love, and try to make devotees for you. And in that attempt of making devotees for you, I will try to diminish my debt, to do something to pay back. So my point in connection to your point is, so some devotees who engage, for example, in sharing Krishna bhakti to others will do so with this idea. Okay, Krishna is so indebted to Sri Radha that he's trying to pay back as Mahaprabhu making devotees for her to assist her in her neediness. So my preaching to others is an attempt to help him to diminish his debt of love as well. So that's another way of conceiving what you are mentioning, to add a few layers to that. But yeah, in brief, what you mentioned, that's a way we can think of attending to Krishna's neediness. But also there are many others. Again, there are devotees, advanced devotees in this world who really are, how to say, internally connected with the neediness of Radha and Krishna in their daily experience, and they are really giving their lives to that. And the extension of that can also appear in the form of serving the neediness of Guru and Vaishnavas. Because the sadhus are also in need. And in many ways of need. For example, the famous verse that depicts this is this famous verse by Rupa Goswami, which arguably could be one of the most important verses regarding the holy name of Krishna. Tunde tanda vinira timbitanute tundavali labdhaye. Karna krodha kadambini gatayate karnarbhute vyaspriham cheto prangana sangini gatayate vijayate sarvendriyanam kritim no jane janita kiyadhviram mritai krishneti varnam dvayi. So Rupa Goswami is saying, how much nectar is in these two syllables? Krishna. I cannot conceive that. So Krishna, please, if you can bless me with something, the only thing I will ask for you is give me unending ears. I only have two to make justice to this sweet current of nectar coming from these two syllables. If I can request one more thing, give me endless tongues so I can give justice, honor, the sweetness of this name. So my point is, Rupa Goswami is a needy person. In that, he's desperate. Well, I mean, he's not writing just poetry to sound cool to the Sampradaya. He's crying desperately, I really need those hundreds and millions of tongues and ears. So he's in need. So that's represented the neediness of the sadhu, of the guru, and the disciple will become the extended ears of the guru. No? And we will lend your ears so the guru can feel some relief in his her divine desperation. So that's another way of understanding how to attend to this principle of divine neediness in connection to the sadhus, who are the representatives of Radha and Krishna in our lives in this world as well. So yeah. Okay, we are almost there. I don't want to run too late for those who are here and may have to leave and honor Prashad, and also we may continue sharing more informally. And also hopefully we can meet some of these days. We will have some other meetings in a few days. I don't recall the days now. Today's Wednesday. On Friday, we'll be at Archana City's place talking on Gaur Lila, and Mahaprabhu is the apex of Tadatmya, or the principle of divine empathy. Saturday will be at Pranada's place, talking also Gaur Lila. Mahaprabhu is an ever-evolving God. What does it mean? On Sunday, we will be at the house of Dira Govinda Prabhu, talking, giving a lecture, the two of us, on the unconditional love of Krishna and how the potential healing that is in this idea, and knowing ourselves fully loved and accepted by Bhagavan. And then on Tuesday, I have one more meeting at Tamal Krishna Prabhu's place, Rangini Bhavan Ashram. So we'll be talking about what's Gaur Purnima all about. Just creating a little bit more churning before Gaur Purnima actually arrives. So hopefully we can meet you there. Thank you so much for your time. Thank you so much again, Rupa Vilas Prabhu, Kumal Kumari, for the invitation. Sri Sri Gaur Nityananda ki jai, Sriman Mahaprabhu ki jai, Gaur Bhakta Vrinda ki jai, Gaur Primanand Haribu, Pancha Kalpatarubhyascha, Kripa Sindhubhya Evacha, Patitanam Pavanevya Vaishnavibhyo Namo, Ananta Koti Vaishnava Vrinda ki jai, Gaur Hari Haribu.